Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Unpacking Organizations, where Shraddha and I go all crazy talking about nerdy topics like org design and workforce planning and how to make the world a better place. How are you doing, Shraddha?
I'm doing very well, trying to make world a better place every day. How are you, Rupert? Are you enjoying really hot summers of London?
I'm loving it. I'm the back. We just did a three-day hackathon with the team. We stayed at a colleague's house, which was unusual. I was sleeping in a tent, and we were developing with AI, and it got very real, very emotional, very intense. Didn't sleep a lot, and we've been vibe coding and doing all sorts, and just integrating AI and trying stuff and spiking stuff and playing. At the same time. So AI is seriously mind-boggling. It is very, very cool. So it's a lot of fun. And I believe
that sounds awesome.
It's very awesome. And I believe one of our favorite things is to read. And Shraddha, you just finished a great book, I hear.
I did. I finished a lot of not so great books also, but let's talk about great books, because there is escape books also that I read, and then there are really good books. So recently I read Melinda Gates' The Next Day. It's a memoir she recently published. I think it was June last month. And she talks about seasons and transitions in life. And I felt that it was so authentic, so real. And she talks so well about why we need to pay more attention towards transitions in life. And I think that's the whole idea about transitions in life is very dear to me, because I feel that that is where we grow as person. Like as organizations, we grow a lot because, you know, what you do in those transitioning moment makes you a little bit more better adult. So it really resonated with
Unpacking Organizations, the Practitioners Podcast, sponsored by OrgView.
We are also very excited that we have a guest today, Brendan Curry. So, Brendan, welcome to our episode. Welcome to our show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here with you, Shraddha and Rupert. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you. So, Brendan, you are the CEO and founder of Work Arts. That is a consulting firm which is helping clients with org design, operating model design, and M&A. And you have very extensive background in really big or manufacturing organizations doing similar work, but also you were in management. You've had like not so HR jobs and HR jobs. And yeah, it's a fascinating career that you have had. So we are so excited to have you here, unpack the work that you do and passionate about, just like the two of us, and talk more about all of that. So welcome. And so before we start anything, I would love to understand that what is Work Arts? It's a cool name. And how did you come about it? It's been several years that you've been leading it. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So Work Arts is a brand that I've given to my work. And, you know, as I was thinking about, you know, building a business again in 2020 and the work that I was planning to do with clients, I thought it was important to have something that spoke to the value proposition, you know. So I certainly bring, you know, sound and proven methodology. You know, I know my standards, I've done the work, you know, to bring, you know, good science, good practice. But at the end of the day, what clients typically hire us for is their trust in us and what we're able to bring out of their teams. So I think I have a very high view of work. So, you know, we spend most of our lives doing it. And if we do it well, it can be quite a virtuous thing that we do, you know, to help people get more out of what they spend most of their lives doing. So there is a sense of purpose in it for me and that too.
And Brandon, before we go into more detail, it'd be great just to get a bit of your history as well. Shraddha made a brief introduction, but just, you know,
Yes.
We know you live in Detroit, but what else?
Yeah. So I'm a musician, I'm a family man, all of that. I spent the first 10 years of my career really working in continuous improvement and implementing team-based production in manufacturing companies. So a lot of shop floor work, which leads you to instructional design and leadership development and performance management, and the things that it really takes to be able to run a management system at scale. And then I spent the second 10 years of my career really working on those capabilities in talent management and organization development, M&A integration, due diligence, those types of things. And then for the last 5 to 7 years of my career, I was just asked to lead human resources, right? So it's been a significant portion of my career reporting to human resources, but never really considered myself an HR professional until I came to a point where I was really accountable for it. And I was really fortunate to be surrounded by brilliant people that wanted me to be successful. And they really did prop me up and make me successful in the first year for sure. But after, leading in a business for about 7 years, decided to venture out in 2020 and start helping clients in the area that I'm most passionate about. And that's really, improving performance through developing their organizations, through designing their organizations, and ultimately making good decisions. So as companies are changing their business models or their strategies, or the scale of the business changes, radically or rapidly, those are typically the use cases where people need help that I can bring.
Awesome. And what kind of music do you do before we move on?
Yeah, today I mostly play in the worship band at my church, but I have a background, playing in rock and roll and alternative music, or
Wow.
some folk, but I mostly play guitar.
Nice.
Very cool. So I'm always fascinated, Brandon, with the transition or with the org design work in manufacturing. And how did you, as you were working in manufacturing, in performance of performance improvement in manufacturing, how did you start to get interest in truly the org design and or OD space? Because I feel that there's such a purist connection to it. Did you feel the same way?
Yeah, I think I was I first so I my mentor was really an Ed Schein fanatic, and so in graduate school, I ran into somebody who was big organizational and culture and leadership. He did his dissertation kind of in a study, revisiting that, and I read everything that Ed Schein wrote, right? And then I'm like, oh, this whole Josie Bass series, this whole series of books. And so I started to read everything that was adjacent, and I came to Ed Lawler and I came to Jay Galbraith, and that was really my introduction to organization design as a part of org development, is how I thought of it. I think some people would argue the other way, but nonetheless, it was definitely thinking of it as a system, and that really spoke to me, because that's really how I got into the field. Was starting in systems engineering and thinking about user interfaces and being observant. So that really spoke to me. So that was, I think ultimately what my first introduction was. And then I just found myself doing the work, and I was operating very intuitively. And I think it was around 2017, 2018, I was working on a major integration where there were significant changes that impacted a lot of people's lives. And somebody asked me if I would like some time with some of the consultants from Cates Kessler. And I'm like, I've never heard of them. So, which I was, probably the only one. And now I know who they are for sure. And I've read a lot of their work. And once I started using kind of their five step methodology, I always say it just made me so much more efficient. I did things in the right order, and I didn't make mistakes and have to go back and do a rework. And so there is a methodology, and not just theirs. Also the redesign flow model is quite good. There's a number of models that are really good. And when I started to expose myself to the standards, if you will, of like the great work that has been written about how to do this work effectively, I just became better at it. I don't know that my designs were necessarily better, but the experience for the client or for the organization I was leading in was much better. I was so much more efficient. I used their time much more respectfully.
And give us a little bit more color on what is better. Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I think I know what not better is. So for me, what I experienced, what I experienced was, you know, typical failure modes that everybody falls into for traps, right? Like, as we start by talking about structure, or we're talking about designing around people, or, you know, you start with the pet interests, and then you come back to why it isn't really good for the business. You know, it's not going to be good for our business to move to that city because that's where the CEO wants to live. Like, it's not going to be good, you know, that's, you know, and this is all the reasons why, you know, so it's not going to be good for us to be a functional organization when, you know, the work that we do has no common customers, no common inventory, no, you know, so those types of things, in the business model, you know, you typically should start there, not find it as a barrier to your design. So.
And Brandon, we were talking before we went on air that for you, you talk about the customer a lot. So your client's customer. And
yeah.
I think it'd be great to triple click on that and how you do that and why it's so important. And maybe to reflect on why is it that so often people don't do that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I have always just done, that people have remarked is different, is I think a lot about the customer, and, you know, no customer, no business. So I find it hard to think about the business model, without talking about the customer. And I think that is part of the conversation that happens with the most senior management team. Like, you won't be on that team for very long if you lose the customer. So there is, I think there is a lot of design work there that is done deeper in the organization that is about functional excellence, or it's about spans and layers, or cost cutting, or other, you know, perfectly fine reasons to try to make changes in an organization. But when it comes down to the most elevated design of the organization, the operating model of the business, it really should tie to the business model, which serves customers, and it serves customers with services or goods, or like, and it has, either it has a durable competitive advantage or it doesn't. You know, so it has a competitor set or it doesn't. And so I think starting there and really thinking about, like, what is our business and who is our customer and why do they buy from us and how is that likely to change over time, it's really grounding for everyone. And I think that, sometimes I talk about, you know, the design process as a way of helping the team find shared interest. So they'll come into a process with their individual interests and, you know, desires for capital and those types of things. But when you get in and you really understand who the customer is and how our business is going to change over time, or at least what our theory is of how the business is going to change over time, it can really bring alignment to the organization and the design and the changes in the design that we need in order to be successful. And then, of course, you have to bring the rest of the whole organization through that. So
it's interesting. I was chatting yesterday to the vice chair of an organization who was very upset and with the performance of the management team and inability of the management team to do a bunch of stuff that needed to be done. And at the heart of her frustration was anecdotal pushing of what their customers want, with no grounding, with no methodology to actually understand, with no mechanism. So it was all hearsay and anecdote.
Mm.
And so that led to things happening that weren't done for robust reasons, that were done for pet projects. And the whole organization is beyond dysfunctional. And it kind of stems from not understanding that really fundamental thing. And she's like, I don't know why we don't have a common reason or understanding for why people buy from us. And that is, and I think would be surprised at how common that actually is. I think you know the great leaders understand that, and the great strategies define that, and then that then drives the org design. But fundamentally, if you don't understand the customer, as you're saying, and why they buy, and therefore what capabilities are needed to execute on that, then you're in trouble. And it, you know, to your point about spans, I mean, spans and layers and functional design, et cetera, et cetera. It's such an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
It's very easy to say, oh, we need to take 10% out. I know it's just D layer.
Yeah.
And to the name of your business, Work Arts, without understanding the work that really needs to happen and who's doing what.
Yeah.
So I find that, you know, I guess if our listeners can have one takeaway from this, I'm sure they'll have more than one. But starting with the strategy, but the strategy should start with, and you said it all, Brandon, I'm just sort of doubling down on what you've already said. What are we doing for our customers, and how is that different? And you use the word, you know, enduring competitive advantage. Like, where does that come from versus the competition? And designing that for your business, not copying someone else's business. And I think the org design professional, which is what you're doing, which is why this is refreshing, is asking those questions and talking about that a lot. And therefore, that's going to... So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, you're being as successful as you are, because... And what's interesting, and you know, our listeners, Brandon has, you know, a few clients that just keep on coming back for more and more and more. So these are long enduring relationships. And the reason they'll be long and enduring is because you're asking those fundamental questions. You're not just going for the quick fix of let's take out spans and layers, because they'll be happy with you for half an hour. Well done, congratulations. And then 6 months later, they'll realize it's a train wreck and they won't bite you back. So, yeah, sorry for tripling down on what you're saying.
No, I can say more. I can even say more than that. Like, as an independent, you know, as a small boutique designer, like, I'm just not, I'll never be best at that. There are firms that are better at spans and layers and taking, you know, they have that playbook and the automation, the AIs that, you know, the army of new MBAs, like, that can do that in a way that, you know, I'm just never going to be best at that. But the idea of having real insight about the organization and its talent, and that's something that gets more valuable the more that you work with a client. And that's another trap that I see actually in organizations. A lot of HR kind of functional delivery models have changed since before COVID to where they're less talent centric. I once had a chance to visit, it was one of the best programs I ever attended with Mark Efron and Jim Shanley, this talent management institute. And, you know, they talked about like what percentage should, you know, your HR business partners know of your top talent, of your high potentials? 100. You should know 100% of your top talent. And if you don't have a functional delivery model that allows you to do that, you know, the insights that come from that, you know, then you're missing a big part of what the value you're supposed to deliver. And I'm really good at that. So when I work in organizations, I get to know the people, you know, through these processes, and it gives me insights that they found valuable. So,
yeah, I totally resonate with that, Brandon, because I've gone through the same program. And I think there is it's not just about looking at your talent, but connecting it to the org design, right? Yes. The talent should be sitting in the right structure as well in order for them to be successful as well. But I'm going back to the customer point, because you made such an important point there, that the value, how do we understand that? What is the value we are creating for the customer? How is this ingrained in our strategy? It's easier to look at it at an organizational level, but if you're doing functional org design, it starts to get a little bit more difficult, because you are two steps removed from that customer. You're an enabling function, and you're like, you know, helping the business to get to customer. So when you're looking from that, like that space of organization, how do you bring the value to the customer discussion? If it is for, say, procurement or finance, which is a little bit more removed from the customers?
The way that I typically go about it, especially if I'm engaged, sometimes I'm engaged by a client and they're like, we want to implement this design, this thing that I've read from Hackett. I want to take this procurement best practice model from Hackett and implement it here. I just attended this conference, or I just listened to this podcast, and I want to do that. It doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It might be a great idea, but I like to, definitely still do a diagnostic and understand from their customer-facing roles, what is happening, what is the experience like with procurement in this example, and what from procurement is desired. So you at least balance it with, what you're hearing from customer-facing part of the business, from, your internal customers, if you will. Yeah, that usually helps. Yeah, I definitely don't want to. A lot of the ideas that spread are good ideas. So I definitely don't want to come against them as though there's no place for them. But to blindly implement best practices is a good way to be average.
I love that a good diagnostic is always needed in order to understand the customer, understand the lay of the land and the strategy, and then connect that what is right in the context. And this whole thinking that you're bringing to our listeners is the systems theory that how things are connected. And sometimes I would say, and I have been guilty of that in my early days as well, that we just don't think about customers, that who exactly are the stakeholders, or we think about the wrong customers. We are scouting for a location and we are thinking about customer, like our CEO as the best customer, right? And where his residence should be. But that's not what's the right customer is. Fantastic.
It's interesting. I think of it sometimes as just operating like an owner, or even an investor, right? Does it make sense to it?
Or dare I say a founder. I don't know if you've read the book, The Founder's Dilemma.
Yes.
I haven't read it. No.
Well, you it feels like you should it feels like you have. So one of the dilemmas, one of the things that it is actually a bunch of Bain guys, three Bain partners that wrote it. It's an excellent book. And I won't give a description of the whole book, but one of the elements is that early stage businesses, founder-led businesses, have an obsession about the customer. And that gets lost as you grow and scale. So as you go through sort of the grainer curve of maturity, leadership gets more and more removed, and the founder goes, and that and therefore that becomes a real issue. They've done a lot of really robust analysis that what they've observed and sort of research is that organizations that are customer obsessive can sustain ROI for much longer, and growth and EBITDA growth and however you want to define success. And many of those that don't fail. And not, so it's maybe another tidbit, given this is going to be the book club of the afternoon, but it's a really, really nice one that just plays on your point. And as you said, owner mindset, the true sense is that what was the founder's belief at the time? What were they trying to achieve and do? And often organizations get divorced from that as they scale. And it gets lost.
I think I developed that a lot. I worked on trying to sell parts of the business and, trying to, do acquisitions. So you're listening to, you're reading CIMs and you're sitting in front of investors and, you're presenting the business, and, how what it could be. And I think just that experience of thinking about, where do our profits come from, and, who are our current customers, and which channels could we grow into, like that, the kind of go-to-market view of I was very fortunate to have those experiences, and it definitely has influenced how I think.
And Brandon, just because you're talking a little bit like you're working very close to the leadership team and the CEO, at least that's how I'm inferring. Are your clients, I mean, are you doing this at what sort of scale of organization, if you don't mind me asking, are you kind of working with?
So my current, the clients that I'm typically working with are in the range of maybe 50 million at the smallest, 40, 50 million, up to, I think the largest client that I have currently is around 8 billion revenue, publicly traded company. Some private and employee-owned companies that are around a billion. I'd say most of them are in that range of, 100 to, 4 billion. Once it gets above that, I've, done quite a lot of functional design, in the 50 plus, billion, or help with change initiatives, specific kind of performance improvement initiatives there. But my clients are typically, I would say below 20 billion, but usually around half that. Yeah.
That's a, I mean, it's a really significant range. The 50 million versus the 8 billion,
Yeah.
right? I mean, there's a several stages of maturity in terms of difference. How do you get the 8 billion or the 20 billion leadership team to think in the same way as the 50? Like, because at that point you're sort of managing an army, and people get even more and more divorced from the customer and what they're doing. So how are you grounding them in these
Yeah.
fundamentals in the way that's much easier to do in a smaller organization? At least that's a, yeah.
Yeah.
Or
I would say
do
that the
you?
so the, I would say the conversations that I'm invited into in the larger businesses, right, bigger than 10 billion, are typically business unit functional specific performance improvement initiatives. I would, but clearly my core client base is in that sub 10 billion range. And usually if I'm, I don't know that I am navigating or steering what the conversation that it should be like the larger businesses, because they have different problems. Most of the time, if they're inviting me in, they have a change in strategy or business model, a threat that they're trying to counter, an acquisition or a carve out that is, quickly changed the scale of their business. So there's typically something that we're responding to, that may be the same case in that 50 to 100 billion, business, but I have not been invited to those conversations yet. Welcome that opportunity, but have not yet.
I just as a sort of a thought and something for for our listeners maybe to ponder on. You think about all these case studies. I mean, how many 20 billion plus organizations have disappeared very rapidly? So the average time that an organization spends in the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, has dramatically declined. So it used to
Yeah.
be plus 35 years, and now it's about 17 years, give or take. Don't stats off the top of my head, so don't quote me on it, but order of magnitude, that's directionally right. And you think of the Nokias of the world that were world beaters, were functionally organized in so many different matrices. They knew what Apple was doing. They had 18 months warning and they couldn't respond, right? Because of the way they were designed, because they were so big and so matrixed and everything else. And so leadership failed. And so there's an organization design issue at the larger scale for thinking and stepping back and cutting through. And that's what a CEO and the leadership team should are basically there to do and to think about. And I think the
For sure.
reason why so many fail at that scale when they've got all the opportunities is because they can't connect those dots and the complexity becomes too great. And as you said, I'm brought in to react to.
Right.
And then,
Some of the insights, like I was saying earlier, some of the insights that you gain when you work with a business for a while too. I've had a couple of clients where it is kind of fundamental to their history. Right. So what brought them to become the organization that they are today, and even their identity, is often a barrier, for them to be able to change, and to do something different, that would either differentiate them and be a durable competitive advantage, or even just to remain legitimate. So I definitely have seen that where organizations struggle with the idea of behaving differently, because of their history or what they value or what the identity is for the people.
yeah. And I'll bring back to the point that you made, Brendan, about the talent as well. So yes, the structure is important because we feel very passionately about it as org design practitioners and thought leaders. But we also feel that the leadership and the mindset of the leaders are also equally important. So many a times in these big organizations, there are like brokers and people who are dinosaurs, and they're just wanting to not change, and regardless of the structure they're in. So do you have any, like, I know we are coming at the top of the hour now, but do you have any thoughts around, like, how do you build that connection between the design thinking and the leadership, who needs to be there, the right leadership? And is that part of your work as well?
Definitely spent a lot of time in talent management and building talent management capabilities, working internally, right? So every organization that I was in, I was building it from scratch and learning, you know, over time how to do that and enable it with technology. But I think there is a point in the process where you have defined the, okay, what are the capabilities that are required? What is the work that makes that up? You know, who's going to do that? There definitely is a point in the process where you're evaluating, like, is this something that we see the talent that we have doing? You know, do we have evidence that we do that in any part of the organization? I wouldn't say that I have a playbook for it. I probably do operate quite intuitively, just as a part of who I am. But there is no judgments on that.
Yeah. Like, you know, if you do it in a beautiful way, in an arts way, you don't need a playbook, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but in order to scale it, I mean, there probably is somebody that has a playbook or a methodology for how to orchestrate that with a team, but I tend to operate quite intuitively. It's a lot of personal, you know, one-on-one conversations with leaders who are accountable for communicating and implementing and delivering the results from these choices. And they often will ask, you know, do you think they can do it? You know, or I'll, you know, position, okay, where's the depth chart of people that you see being able to deliver that? How many do you think you need? And so it doesn't take too many questions for them to realize that this is fundamentally different from what brought us to where we are. And Rupert, to your example earlier, it is often a bold move by the board or by a very senior leader to do something drastically different that is needed in order for an organization to make those shifts, like you said.
Unfortunately, as Morpheus said in The Matrix, time is always against us. So, Ben, just to wrap up, one tool and one trap.
One tool. I'm quite a fan of modeling. So I like options, right? And I challenge myself to say, just because I understand it, doesn't mean that they do. So I like to model options out to say, what does this actually do to the metrics that matter to the organization? Can we model that? And, you know, just to make sure that all the different lenses around the table are really thinking through these options in ways that matter to them and to the things that they're accountable for. So wherever possible, I really do like to, you know, model. When I do diligence, I like to model, like, give me 3 years of pay history. You know, let me model out what they're going to cost you under your compensation practices, you know, not necessarily theirs, because theirs maybe have different interests for a business that's preparing to sell. So, you know, that type of a modeling is a great tool. But I think for other designers, like mentors would be, you know, the tool that I don't think people use enough. And I've found the community within organization design to be very generous, very willing to spend time with you, to share their resources, their practices. So that would be the one. What is the one hack that, you know, people underutilize? I think mentors or the community itself is something that I would encourage people to tap into. Be bold. You know, what's the worst thing they can say is I'm too busy or not respond. Yeah. So I've found the community at all levels. I mean, the people that write all the books, these are very generous people. They would like nothing more than to help their expertise be used. So
that includes Rupert as well.
The second question was, what was the second part of it? Trap. Yeah, I already criticized benchmarking. I'm going to double down. I think
Double down
the
on that.
yeah, the biggest trap sometimes is implementing somebody else's strategy. It's a good way to be
Yeah.
average. Yeah.
I
Amen to
love
that,
that.
Brandon. That's one of
Yes.
my hot away horses as well. It's, yeah, I see that so often. And then you give the benchmarks because you're forced to, and you say don't, and then all they do is argue about it. It's such a waste of time. And Yeah.
you end up, and you have that in the, actually, dare I say it, in the automotive industry, is probably one of the worst. Copying each other, and
Because there is
benchmarking
data.
consistently.
Yeah, because there's more data there, I feel that there's more data,
All
you
the
draw
cars start
more.
looking the same, and then all of a sudden Tesla comes along, and then the Chinese are coming along, and it's like,
And that doesn't mean that the ideas are not good. Just consider them one option, right? But you don't need a designer to do
can
that.
become, but they often become a slave to it, which is, I think, to your point.
I think the other tool, if I could, that I've just found to be a carryover from my start in continuous improvement. I just, grew up in lean and the Gemba management. Go see, understand, show respect. That to me today looks like diagnostic work. But that often is just spending time, like actually, what is the business doing right now? I'm shocked at how many businesses don't really know what's happening right now because the data isn't very good, or it's really hard to cut through the layers of filtering that happens before the information gets up to them. So having a part of the diagnostic that really does understand, like, where are you starting from? That is critical. Not to say you want to put all of your resources there, but it is important to have a sense and respect for what is making your organization right now. So.
Love that.
Amazing.
Brandon, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you
Thank
so
you.
much for joining us, sharing all your wisdom and excitement about the work that you do. It was really beneficial. So thank you for joining us, and thank you to all the listeners who are listening to us and tuning into our podcast. And Rupert, thank you the
Thank you,
most.
Shraddha.
Thank
Take
you
care.
both.
Thanks. Bye.
Unpacking Organizations, the Practitioners Podcast, sponsored by OrgView.